What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we're taking a look at the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, 9 tons of cocaine was seized and destroyed. So why did French Polynesia allow those responsible to sail away? Palau's Senate moves to block a plan to accept deportees from the U.S. And Tonga's Prime Minister reaches out to Washington to reset diplomatic relations following a U.S. travel ban. We'll have more on those stories coming up. Pacific Review comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, 9 tons of cocaine was seized and destroyed by the French Navy in international waters near French Polynesia. Authorities say 2 vessels were intercepted in separate operations over the past 3 weeks. In both cases, the drugs were dumped at sea and the ships and their crew allowed to leave. French Polynesia's president, Moetai Brotherson, says that's because the vessels were stopped outside French territorial waters.
They will probably eventually see a courtroom either in the country of destination or in the country where they are from. But, we have already a few crews from former ships that were transporting drugs that are now, I would say, crowding our prisons. So it's not our, I would say, vocation to accommodate all these drug smugglers. So we leave it to the country of origin or the country of destination.
So does that therefore mean that part of the responsibility you believe lies with Australia?
Well, it's not a question of responsibility. It's a question of prosecution. Who wants to prosecute those people? I mean, and it's my understanding that they were not arrested in our waters, but at the border of our EEZ. Therefore, it's an international matter.
Do you not, though, have some concern that, regardless of the explanation you've given, that what French Polynesia has done is send out something of a signal to would-be drug smugglers that they can get away with things, potentially?
Well, they're not getting away with much because, when we have 5 tons of cocaine and we have another boat that was seized, I think it was yesterday, and when you throw all the merchandise, in the ocean, it's a big loss for these drug dealers.
What have the authorities in French Polynesia done in terms of linking up with other, I presume, police forces and governments around the world to ensure that doesn't happen, that these individuals don't?
Of course, there is an ongoing international cooperation between all the police forces, all the customs throughout the Pacific. These guys were pointed to us by the U.S., and we, of course, have sent all the reports on the seizing that was done on the ship, the nature of the drugs, all the information that was collected from the crew has been passed on to all these police forces and customs around the Pacific.
So as president of French Polynesia, how concerned are you that this problem that you've had to deal with is happening too often? You mentioned earlier, I think, that there'd been another seizure within the last 24 hours.
Our EEZ is 5 million square kilometers, so the probability of ships either crossing or going, close to our EEZ on their way from America to Australia or New Zealand is quite high. So, of course, we are concerned. We are not the primary target, the primary market of these ships. But still, I mean, we have seen instances where, besides the primary target, part of the shipping was dropped off on our shores. So this is a main concern to us. We have declared war to drugs in our country. So we are very concerned about all these trafficking routes.
Do you feel that French Polynesia is particularly vulnerable because of your location, the size of your EEZ, and the fact that you have a small economy? Do you feel you need assistance from bigger countries to deal with this?
Well, as you may know, French Polynesia is not an independent country. We are a French collectivity, French overseas collectivity, and all the matters of army, police, and justice are in the hand of the French state. The monitoring and surveillance of our EEZ is done by the French army. And they are cooperating with all the neighboring countries. If your question is, do they have sufficient means? Of course, my answer will be no. But are they doing what they can? They are doing their best.
You say that the crew that were responsible for smuggling these drugs will be brought to justice eventually, but do you know where they are now? Are they being tracked? And if so, by who?
Oh, they are being actively tracked by all the police forces, the armed forces throughout the Pacific. So, you know, there is a, how would you say that, there is a handover, depending on the area where you are, of which force is going to track you, but they are definitely being tracked.
And that was French Polynesia President Moetai Brotherson speaking there to the ABC's Richard Ewitt. The president of Palau, Sarangal Whips Jr., is pushing ahead with a controversial plan to resettle deportees from the United States, despite fierce political opposition at home. As Finau Fonua reports, there are calls for a referendum after senators voted through a bill designed to block the deal with Washington.
Palau's president is calling it a move to help a longtime friend. And on Christmas Eve last year, he inked a deal with the U.S. to resettle 75 third country deportees from the U.S. The signing caught many by surprise, but President Sarangal Whips told the ABC the move would benefit Palau.
The way we look at it is actually the U.S. has now helped us increase our capacity to address other things. For example, one of our biggest challenges is drugs coming into Palau, organized crime from Chinese syndicates. The agreement is very clear. At any time, if we want to stop, we can stop. And this is an opportunity for us to help our closest friend and ally. In fact, we actually say we're even more than that. We're family.
But it's clear not everyone agrees. A month after signing, Palau's Senate passed a bill prohibiting the entry, residence, employment, or long-term stay of individuals removed by foreign governments. It also called for the public to voice their views through a national referendum. Leilani Reklai, the editor of the Island Times newspaper, says despite the moves in the Senate, little has changed.
The MOU is still in place. The law is not passed yet. It requires two-thirds of both houses to override the president, which is very unlikely at this time.
She says the second arm of Palau's legislature, the House of Delegates, would need to pass the Senate's bill for it to become law. And until that happens, she says the government is pushing ahead with resettlement plans.
According to our president, they've already started preparing dormitories at our local community college to house the first 10 people that they expect to receive. They don't have a specific date yet as to when those 10 people will be brought in.
The ABC has sought comment from the president's office about the Senate's move to block his MOU, but his office says President Whips is traveling and unavailable for an interview.
For Palau, this initiative serves three purposes. It is helping a long-standing partner, the United States. It helps meet our need for professionals and tradespeople. And it offers a small number of vulnerable people a chance to rebuild their lives in safety and dignity as part of our community.
Palawan Ungarong Kambis runs a think tank and is a longtime political watcher. He says public opinion is split between the president and, on the other side, the Senate and Council of Chiefs. Mr. Kambis believes there'll be political consequences for President Whips for pushing ahead with this plan.
It does not reflect well with the elected leadership. When they fail to hammer out a deal, they are very influential, and the president and the leaders cannot just dismiss what the Council of Chiefs are saying, or the position of the traditional chiefs.
The House of Delegates has yet to set a date on when it will consider the bill. But regardless of the outcome, Mr. Kambis says there'll be a political cost to Palau's leaders.
It's not going to look good for President Whips, because he still have over maybe nearly three years to go before his term is up. And he's going to become, if the public rejects this deportees deal, then he becomes a lame duck president for the next 3 years.
And that was political commentator Kambis Onerung in Palau, ending that report from Finau Funua. The Australian government says it's a win-win, but an in-depth report on the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme says it must address persistent issues of exploitation, denial of basic rights, and policy shortfalls. Right now, the PALM scheme employs more than 30,000 workers from the Pacific and Timor-Leste in regional Australia, who take on a range of jobs in agriculture, meat processing, and aged care. But as Lucy Cooper reports, even supporters of the scheme are calling for urgent reform.
From his work on a farm in southwestern New South Wales, Gabriel Palmer has been able to pay for his 5 children to go to school, set up a small business, and build a house for his family and parents back home in the Solomon Islands.
It's amazing, because I was really improve my family. When I come back here, I send money to my children, my wife, and help my sibling. So this is a great thing for me as well.
Employed under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, also known as the PALM Scheme, Gabriel Palmer first came to work in Griffith in 2020. His employer, Jonathan Moss, is a wholesale nursery grower based in the New South Wales Riverina town.
When you're dealing with a live product that needs to be picked or packed or worked on today, not tomorrow, not yesterday, you need reliability. And that's what the PALM scheme has created for us as a company.
90% of Mr. Moss's employees are from the PALM scheme.
It's a brilliant scheme because it works both ways. You know, we have skilled, dedicated workers and employees, and then we obviously pay them the Australian award wage, and they take that money back, which is severely multiplied, and it changes their lives.
The scheme is the focus of a new report released today titled Improving PALM. Its author is Peter Mayers.
It's important to see this as a form of cooperation between Australia and the Pacific, not as Australia somehow bestowing some great benefit on the Pacific.
An independent researcher and writer, Mr. Mayers was commissioned by the Scanlon Foundation Research Institute. After several months of research and interviewing employees, employers, country liaison officers, volunteers, unions, academics, and researchers, he's made 10 recommendations to the government to improve the scheme.
I think the most important reform is to give palm workers themselves greater agency, and that means to give them a greater right, to make it easier for palm workers to change jobs within Australia.
Palm visas tie a worker to their approved employer, which Mr. Mayers says leaves workers with very few choices if they're ill-treated or underpaid. If they speak up, they fear that they may be sacked and sent home. Improving health outcomes for workers is also a key recommendation.
One of the other things that concerns me about the PALM scheme is the fact that PALM workers don't have access to Medicare.
Mr. Mayers says the scheme is a triple win for workers' incomes and remittances, for regional employers, and amidst a strategic rivalry with China, a win for Australia's Pacific relationships.
I didn't speak to anyone deeply engaged in the scheme who thought it was a bad idea. I didn't speak to anyone who wanted to scrap the scheme, but a lot of people think it can be improved. And the key issues are around the exploitation of workers by some employers.
For Solomon Islander Gabrielle Palmer, he's happy to take skills from the nursery back home.
I learned some skill here that if I go back to my community, then I will try to doing that skill, apply that skills to the community. Maybe the community will benefit as well.
And that was Palm Scheme worker Gabrielle Palmer from Solomon Islands, ending that report from Lucy Cooper. You're listening to Pacific Review on the ABC. I'm Evan Wasuka. The Prime Minister of Tonga, Lord Fakafanua, has invited the US Deputy Secretary of State to visit the kingdom in a bid to strengthen ties with Washington. The invitation comes after the United States imposed a travel ban on Tongans by putting a block on new visitors and student visas. Lord Fakafanua says Tonga has been caught in the crossfire surrounding the changes in US global security policy.
From what we understand, Homeland Security in the United States is looking at securing the US borders, and their broad approach towards securing the US borders has resulted in Tonga losing our privileges regarding applications for visitors and schooling visas. A student visa and visitors from Tonga can no longer apply from the 1st of January. It's an unfortunate situation that we can understand that due to the number of overstayers, we've breached the percentage threshold that Homeland Security was looking at for all countries that are overstaying in the United States. Even though when you look at the numbers, it's not a lot of people per number, but on a percentage basis, it's definitely breached the threshold. So Tonga has been grouped together with other countries that are negatively impacting the border security of the United States. And that's what we need to address with the relevant departments in America.
Lord Prime Minister, is this a diplomatic issue? We all understand the geopolitics issue around the Pacific, particularly in this case for Tonga and Tonga's relationship with China and also other Western countries. Should Tongans see this as a sign of strain in Tonga-US relations, or is Tonga being caught up in a wider US policy?
Most definitely, Tonga is being caught up in a wider US policy. You can probably say that Tonga's collateral damage. We are a close friend and ally of the United States. We have a large diaspora who enjoy the benefits that the United States has offered for their lives and the opportunities that our students and business people get. We have multiple generations of Tongans who have grown up now in the United States. In terms of the diplomatic relations, this is just a small aspect of our engagement with the United States. Mm. We're in an unfortunate situation right now where we have to deal with it, but it's something that we can work through.
Yes. Prime Minister, you said during your first press conference that you invited one of the US senior official to visit Tonga. Was that invitation made in response to this issue, and has the US formally replied?
I was very fortunate enough to be called on early in my term by Deputy Secretary of State Lin Dao. We had a very good conversation about the potential of deepening and strengthening our relationship with the United States and Tonga. I had to raise the issue of the visa restrictions that were recently imposed on our people. And on the back of an investment forum that the United States is hosting in Hawaii, I reciprocated the invitation for him to visit Tonga as part of his broader engagement with the Pacific. And visa access is important. It's a front of mind for most Tongans. But this is just part of a broader engagement with the United States. We're looking at inviting more foreign investment. As you're aware, my government is encouraging business, and Tonga wants to look at all the opportunities available for doing business. I've always advocated for a greater economy to address a lot of our social and economic strifes. What better opportunity to demonstrate that partnership than to have a senior official visit Tonga early this year?
What immediate steps are you taking on protecting ordinary Tongans and family church groups, students who rely on traveling to the United States?
My understanding from U.S. immigration is that anyone who has existing valid visas are still able to travel to the United States. Mm. The restriction is on foreign citizens who are applying for new visas. Mm. They're still going to honor your existing visa if it's still valid. So those who have valid visas can still travel to the United States.
I know it's too early to tell, but how soon do you think or realistically expect this to be resolved? You know, what assurance that you might give Tongans who are worried about these decisions?
We're definitely prioritizing this as something that we hope we can resolve as soon as possible. We have no direct control over the timeline, but I'm confident that we have a pathway forward, and we're just working to unlock everything as soon as possible.
Tonga's Prime Minister, Lord Whakawhanua, speaking there to the ABC's reporter in Tonga, Marion Kupu. The United Nations Resident Coordinator for Fiji, Solomon Islands, Tonga, Tuvalu and Vanuatu, Dirk Wagner, says funding for development projects in the Pacific won't be affected by a funding crisis at the UN headquarters. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that more than $1.5 billion in unpaid dues has left the organization on the brink of financial collapse. However, Mr. Wagner says the project money comes from a different source, but core functions of the UN are under threat.
The regular budget, which is basically the membership dues which member countries have to pay for the UN, they cover the UN principal organs, the core governance functions, the secretariat functions, the political missions. But the UN development system globally, so in the Pacific, receives mostly a different funding stream. And these are the so-called voluntary contributions. So these are contributions that member states make to the UN agencies. And we have about 30 UN agencies that work across the Pacific. And they fund those agencies either through voluntary core contributions or through specific contributions and make earmarked to projects and specific initiatives. So those initiatives which we are delivering here in the Pacific, the majority are not funded through the regular budget, but through voluntary contributions. However, that should not distract from the issue, because the very core architecture of the United Nations is under threat, and we need those assessed contributions from the member states to ensure that the system is functioning as a whole.
How much would a financial collapse undermine development in the Pacific?
There are many, many elements of the United Nations that are financed through their regular budget, core functions of the Secretariat, the regional economic commissions, but also organs such as the International Court of Justice that has just delivered a landmark advisory opinion on the obligations of member states when it comes to protecting its citizens from the negative impact of climate change, which has been brought about through the concerted effort of Pacific Island students and a number of Pacific Island countries. So, of course, we need the core function of the UN to be intact. And, you know, one of the issues we are facing is a certain downward movement when it comes to those contributions, because we face two problems. On the one hand, we have late or non-payment of dues. But on the other hand, we also have budgetary rules and regulations, unfortunately, that oblige the UN to return whatever they haven't spent in terms of budget, whether they have received it actually or not. So if we have a shortfall of $1.56 billion in outstanding dues, that means we have to actually credit that back to member states in the following year, which they have to pay less in dues. So that means we have, again, less funding available in the regular budget. And that is truly accelerating now, and that can lead to a liquidity crisis.
It's not just development that's impacted, it's also foreign relations and security, right?
The International Court of Justice is financed through the regular budget, but we have also the Security Council and the core international human rights architecture, such as the Human Rights Council and the Universal Periodic Review process. So many, many processes that are very important for the Pacific, including CEDAW, the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. We have so many important bodies that belong to the architecture of the UN that face shortages. And of course, you know, we're doing the very best we can, you know, on our end to be more efficient, to be better in what we do with less. But at the same time, the bottom line remains. The Secretary General has written to all member states and has basically asked them to honor their dues when it comes to providing assessed funding to the United Nations.
And with that call, do you think they will honor that?
Well, I'm very much convinced, because we remain very much committed to working, of course, closely with all member states to ensure the continued delivery of our work, and that work is important to all member states. And I think the current moment is also an opportunity for member states to demonstrate their collective stewardship of the UN and to reinforce the financial architecture and the financial foundations that are needed for the effective multilateral action.
Who is to blame for this?
Two reasons. One, a delayed or non-payment of assessed contributions. So that needs to change. So those 43 member states that, you know, haven't paid in the last year or in the last couple of years, they are, of course, encouraged, you know, to make up and to pay their outstanding dues.
And that was Dirk Wagner, the UN resident coordinator for Fiji, Solomon Islands, Tonga, Tuvalu and Vanuatu. And he was speaking there to the ABC's Agnes Tupou. You've been listening to Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific.